Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Welcome back to Venus Rising. Today we have award-winning independent journalist and author Jennifer Block on the show. We'll be talking with Jennifer about her work, including her newest book, Everything Below the Waist, Why Healthcare Needs a Feminist Revolution. You might have read her work in the BMJ, the New York Times, Romper, Washington Post Magazine, The Baffler, and many other publications. Her first book, Pushed, led a wave of attention to the national crisis in maternity care and was named Best Book of 2007 by the Kirkus Reviews. A reporter with the Type Investigations, Block has won several awards for her investigative reporting on the permanent contraceptive implant, Assure, which has since been discontinued. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me, Callie. Yes. Happy to be here.
I'm so excited. We only have about an hour, but I have so much to talk with you. I actually just finished your most recent book, which I'm going to abbreviate Everything Below the Waist. And so before we begin, there was a quote in that book that I felt like just really stood out to me and kind of encompassed the whole thing. It was from a gal, Tanika Gray, and she states, "It's very hush-hush, very taboo. And when you think about it, I really think despite cultural, socioeconomic status and race, I really think as women, we're taught you just don't talk about issues below the belt. I think we let that grow into how we think about our health." And in that quote, Tanika is specifically talking about hysterectomies. That's kind of your chapter on that. But I think it's a quote that really appropriately summarizes the attitude that we have around women's health and women's issues in general. So with that in mind, let's talk about those issues and your work in this space. So first of all, just tell us about you and what made you interested in reporting on these types of topics, in covering topics about health and gender, specifically women's health. What's your passion there?
Well, you know, honestly, like many people, I in a way stumbled upon this beat. I started my career as an intern at Ms. Magazine over 20 years ago now. So I obviously, you know, was interested in women and feminism, but, you know, I was not interested in health or medicine per se. I come from a family with a bunch of doctors and, you know, I'd never had an interest in going to medical school. I'm less squeamish now, but was way too squeamish back then to even think about that. So it wasn't really like what I was interested in, but I ended up getting hired at Ms. and the health editor had just left and they asked me if I would kind of take over the health mail and sort of fill in, if you will. And so I ended up, you know, getting all the mail. Back then we actually did get a lot of print mail. That's how old I am, I guess. And I, you know, edited the, like, we had, you know, the page in the magazine for health notes. And while I was there, I, you know, a piece of hard paper copy, you know, material came across my desk that started me on the beat of maternity care, really, and led to Pushed. There's no other way to say it. I mean, I started to, you know, I called some people, you know, I had no context. I was 23 years old. None of my friends were getting pregnant or having kids. So it wasn't like I came to that topic with any preconceived ideas. And like I said, I come from a family of doctors, but, you know, I started interviewing people and I guess I'm a good listener. You need to be a good listener to be a good reporter. And I've always found that I get my story ideas from listening to people and, you know, being interested in women and, you know, end up talking to a lot of women. And, you know, what I was hearing just was very disturbing. You know, I was talking to doulas about what they were seeing in hospitals. I was talking to women who had given birth and felt like, you know, their bodies hadn't been respected, their choices hadn't been respected. And I was looking at the data and seeing the rising rate of C-section, which was maybe 25% back then, and the rising number of women who were being induced into labor with drugs and procedures. And, you know, I went to my editors at Ms. who were older and, you know, they were like, wait, we had the natural childbirth movement. We had Lamaze, you know, like there's no problem. I gave birth 10 years ago. It was fine. And so, you know, I just dug deeper. So that, that ended up leading, to make a long story short, to Push. And that was my first book. I was, you know, pretty young. I had basically stumbled on a story that was just way too big. And it was frustrating because it's a story that I wasn't the first one to tell. You know, there was a book in the 70s by Suzanne Arms. Was it called Immaculate Deception? Was that her book? It was an expose of maternity care. When I read it, I was like, oh my God, you know, this is all sounding very familiar, you know. Push still has quite a life. That book is still taught in university courses, and it's in doula training. It's required reading for doula and midwifery training. I still see new reviews come up on Amazon. So it's you know, it seems like it's a perennial issue. So anyway, that to get a long-winded way to answer your question. I just sort of fell into it. And I was like a naive, like I said, 20 something when I stumbled upon this topic. And I was like, oh my dear me, how could we be doing things that aren't based on the evidence? Dear me, like why would this be happening? And I thought, oh, this is like, well, this is just specific to childbirth. You know, this is just this area of medicine, which is still like just lagging on evidence-based care and lagging on informed consent. But really, when I came out of that book and I started looking more broadly at the landscape of healthcare generally, but really, I think I still stand by the argument that women are more vulnerable to the system. You know, I saw that a lot of the patterns that I noticed with maternity care were playing out with hysterectomies, and the overuse of drugs earlier in life, and sort of the general theme of like too much treatment that is not needed and is ultimately, you know, causing more harm than good. And at the same time, not enough of the treatment that women do need. And, you know, I just want to say here, so I'm generally speaking about, when I say women, I'm talking about people who are identifying as women and are not transitioning medically. But I'm also talking to people who may not identify as women, but haven't transitioned. And my reporting, I can't really speak to the population of people who were born female and are transitioning medically with hormones and surgery, because my reporting and research just like didn't, I couldn't go there. And actually there's not really much data. Like I don't really know what to say about endometriosis for someone who is transitioning.
Sure.
Because with hormones and surgery, that like that's beyond the scope. So I just want to kind of lay that foundation out there. But anyway, so yeah, so that's how I've kept on this beat. And you know, yeah, that, I mean, the healthcare system is a problem for everyone. But as I looked more broadly at what's happening throughout the lifespan of women in the U.S., I noticed these patterns repeating of over treatment.
And I've read your books and I agree. I think that both of them really should be mandatory for anyone who's considering a career in women's health or women's research or anything, because I, especially in Everything Below the Waist, it's my most recent read. There are times that I just felt so like I could personally relate, because I first started my life as a women's health. I did women's health research specifically in endometriosis and dioxin. You talk about that in your book. And then now I'm a labor and delivery nurse in, you know, so I like seeing the, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like what I'm seeing and experiencing, but I couldn't have put it into my own words. So it's just a very validating book and very eye-opening. But talking about Everything Below the Waist at the very beginning of your book, it's kind of a jolt. And I've read other reviews and listened to podcasts about you talking about it. And to some people, it's really maddening to hear how women are treated in healthcare, as it should be. And, you know, you talked about the claim that women are more vulnerable than men for over-testing, over-diagnosis, over-treatment. And this is probably a really complex question with a lot of answers, but do you have, and in the book you talk about it, so I encourage everyone to go read it, but do you have like kind of a short answer as to like, why do you think that is? What's like the bottom line? Why are women so much more vulnerable than men in this space?
Well, I think like everything in life, it's complicated. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons. I think that, you know, one thing I am always interested in doing is going back to the history of how we got somewhere. And, you know, when you look at the history of medicine in general and the history of gynecology and obstetrics in particular, it's pretty ugly. You know, there was a lot of experimentation and surgery that was unconsented to on enslaved women. And so, you know, the idea that, you know, consent for procedures was, it wasn't even an idea in the origins of medicine. So that's, you have to kind of like think about that's baked into the history.
And I feel like a lot of people don't realize that. Like, I was reading your book and just, it was very sobering to read those pages. And you talk about a little bit at the beginning and then a little bit in the middle, and just kind of the foundations being born out of this racist ideology and rooted in the institution of slavery. So you talk about Dr. Sims and the fact that he was doing these procedures, and not just slaves, but his slaves, Black women. And I love this, that if he's considered, you know, the father of OB care, gynecology, then those women are the rightful mothers of the branch of this medicine. And I don't think people know that or get the credit.
And that's Deidre Cooper Owens, who deserves credit for that quote. And she wrote a wonderful book. She's a scholar, I think, at the University of Nebraska now. And her book is called Medical Bondage, if anyone is interested in looking at that further. Yeah. And so, you know, that's not, you know, to say that like we can apply the ethics and mores and, you know, the actions of those founders of medicine to today exactly. Like, that was history. This is now. However, you can certainly trace line. And then the other important thing to know is that, you know, the profession of obstetrics was, you know, the history of obstetrics is really a hostile takeover of a profession that was dominated by women of color, immigrant women, indigenous women. And, you know, and that also is a very ugly history. And so, like, you know, that's one reason. So we have these branches of medicine that, you know, they're on like foundations of racist and sexist ideology, right? And the other, you know, there are lots of complicating factors. But, you know, we also, you know, as modern women, I think that like we believe that if we're, you know, taking good care of our bodies, if we're being good girls, it's been kind of ingrained in us that we go to the doctor and get our annual exam. And maybe this is becoming, you know, maybe this is becoming less true. I it's interesting, the quote that you started out with, because I do feel hopeful that with social media and the kind of like just culture of oversharing that we have now, that it's not as true. And I think Tamika actually was specifically talking about like in her family, in her African American community, like talking about what was going on with fibroids and hysterectomies. It was like taboo. And I think that's also really like generational, because I see millennials and Gen Z like super willing to share. And I think they've really made it more, you know, they think they've kind of opened up Gen Xers, which is my, you know, my cohort. They've like allowed everyone to come out, and like, I mean, millennials will like share the like color of their period on Instagram. They'll like, you know, they'll take pictures of it. So I don't think, you know, I think we're getting better in that regard. But so another piece of this is that women are just more often exposed to medicine. Like, you know, if we're being told, you know, we're modern women, if we're being good girls, you know, we're supposed to go get an annual exam, right? An annual pelvic exam, even. Some people are still being told, which we can talk about, like the differences between like what's actually evidence-based. Like, yes, you should get a pap test every few years, but do you need to get your vagina checked out every year? No, you don't. There's been massive study of it, and it's pretty much sure to cause more harm than good. And it's also just, you know, unpleasant for most people. So, you know, just by virtue of that, I mean, the American medical system favors intervention. That's true across the board. So it doesn't matter who you are. Once you're in the situation of stepping into a medical office or a hospital, unfortunately, the system reimburses for actions. And so what you may really need is to talk to someone for 20 minutes or a half hour or an hour. And, you know, they might need to like find out what you're eating and what you're doing. And, you know, maybe what you needed at the end of the day was really just, you know, to eat less pizza. Like I'm just throwing that out there.
Sure. But
my point is that, you know, those conversations and those lifestyle interventions and things that are not prescriptions, tests, procedures, surgeries, it's really hard to get reimbursed.
It's not billable. I chatted with them about diet, you know.
Right. And I mean, there are people, like, I'm not the only one who's by far saying this. There are lots of people who are in quality assurance. I'm losing the term for it, but there are a lot of people concerned about this phenomenon of fee-for-service care resulting in an overuse of testing and overuse of treatments. And so, like, it doesn't matter who you are. Once you're in that setting, you're vulnerable to overtreatment just because you're in the United States. And, you know, you might get tests you don't need. You might end up with a prescription that's not really appropriate for what's going on, et cetera. So that's true across the board. But women, because we were told to go every year, and also I think, you know, we have these reproductive systems that work differently. We have these hormonal cycles, these monthly hormonal cycles, and we know that we've got a lot of environmental hormone disruptors. And so things are often going wonky, and there are pregnancies and miscarriages, and there are lots of reasons for us to end up in the medical setting with pain, with complications, right? So that's one reason why we're more vulnerable. And then the other piece I think that I talk about in my book is there's been a blind spot in advocacy, you know, and I retrace the history of, you know, the feminist health movement, which was very active in the 70s, and how it sort of kind of got subsumed by a more mainstream, quote unquote, liberal feminism that was more concerned with external equality and all very important things, you know, making sure that women had the same opportunity to enter professions that had been closed off to them prior, making sure we had economic equality. And, you know, like, these are all really important. But what I did notice was that the feminist health movement, which was like, you know, a subset of the women's movement, of the second wave women's movement, that was really very interested in our physiology and very celebratory and curious. And, like, you know, they were the ones who got up on tables naked and did the cervical exams and taught other women how to do the cervical exams. And they really had this, like, ethic of take charge, and, like, let's learn all we can learn. Let's do as much as we can so that we don't have to be in the position of vulnerability, naked in stirrups in a doctor's office with, at the time, those were, you know, it was mostly older male doctors who would be standing there between your legs. and often they were, like, in charge of whether or not you got birth control and whether or not you got an abortion. And so they really were like, we can do a lot of this ourselves. Let's do it. And let's try to be as healthy as we can be without having to rely on the medical system and pharmaceuticals. That movement kind of fell by the wayside. And I think it left a gap in advocacy. And so the some of the most concerning issues that I see in women's health are ones that really haven't been taken up by the mainstream feminist advocacy organizations. And even I have a whole chapter on how, like, women's health advocacy has in many instances been co-opted by pharmaceutical interests. Like, a lot of these organizations take a lot of pharma money now. Their leaders are, you know, more marketing people than health experts. And so we've had some embarrassing situations, like feminist health advocates backing a pink Viagra drug that really showed no efficacy and some really like unpleasant side effects like fainting and yeast infections. So I would say, like, of course it's like it's very complicated, and a lot of like we're all vulnerable to these exigencies of the system. And I think with COVID now, we have seen just how much power hospitals can have. I think in a way that maybe not everyone realized, you know? And so now I think like, and you can look and see that women, people giving birth during COVID have been some of the most, I would say, inhumanely treated. And I have problems with a lot of the ways that the humanity that we, the humanity that we've restricted in the name of COVID safety in terms of people on their deathbeds and
delivering alone. I mean, in San Francisco, there are hospitals where partners weren't allowed to join. And I agree with you there. I thought this is completely unethical. Bringing life into the world and life leaving the world, I feel like, are two places that you should never be alone unless you want to be. Mm-hmm. And in the name of COVID safety, we kind of disregarded that for a long time. And I agree. It was really, really challenging to be a part of that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting when you know, on the one hand, yes, it's like just what we feel is the right thing to do spiritually, religiously, whatever, wherever that comes from. We feel like it's a right of people to not be alone in these situations. And then when you also look at the impact on outcomes, like there's a real impact. Right. There's a real impact for people, for elders who are in the hospital for more than a few days without contact, without physical in-person contact with their loved ones. They're more likely to become delirious. They're more likely to be sicker, and they're more likely to never leave the hospital.
Never go home. Yeah. Yeah. And the same for doulas. Like, studies have shown so many times that doulas, especially in care of persons of color, their impact is astonishing. And then to say, oh, we just don't allow doulas because of COVID. And so it's like, okay, well, we're going right back to, you know, substandard care. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that really disturbed me and irked me, and one thing I tried to investigate early in the pandemic was the separation of infants. Mm-hmm. And mothers. And, you know, that was, there was separation happening before you could even test positive. If there was just an unknown COVID status, babies were being separated. If there was a positive but no symptoms, babies were being separated. If there was, you know, and so that's like the WHO clearly recommends against that. And the illogic of the policy was so obvious to many nurses and physicians I talked to, who said, like, we're taking the baby away for however many days these two are in the hospital to keep them safe. And then we're putting them right back together to say goodbye and send them home. But now we've disrupted their bonding. We've disrupted the breastfeeding relationship. We've traumatized both of them. How is this, you know? But anyway, so like, you can see how we all, you know, anyone who ended up in the hospital because of COVID dealt with a heightened authority of hospital regulation and policy. And even in that situation, women giving birth were dealing with special, unique insults and restrictions to their bodily integrity and humanity.
Yeah. Agreed. I talk with Teresa Morris as well, and she's author of Cut It Out, and she talks about policy and how that's really damaging to women's health, especially in the C-section epidemic. So we'll chat about that with her. But I want to go back a little bit to talk to you. You mentioned kind of this conflict of interest, so to speak, sometimes with these advocacy groups and also pushing big pharma. And it's interesting because I had a gal on the show, Valerie Landis, who works for the fertility industry. And she's very much pro the newest trend in third-party reproduction, which is egg freezing. It's just something that's offered to women. And she kept using it in this like male-female, like, we're finally able to catch up with men who are fertile forever, you know? And it was just so interesting when I was reading this book, those parallels of this hijacking and us trying to be more like men and the freedom that reproductive autonomy offers. But you kind of touch on all of this in your chapter 2, which is your focus on fertility. So I want to focus a little bit on that, because in that chapter, you actually mention our documentary, Exploitation, which listeners can find for free on our YouTube channel. Yes, go ahead. I see you have a question there. Oh, okay, cool. And this documentary, Exploitation, follows women that were harmed during egg donation, not egg freezing, but egg donation. And that's an area that's gravely understudied, but utilized widely anyway. And I want to talk to you about that too, which is the lack of research in women's health care. But in this chapter of the book, you talk about infertility, the solutions that modern medicine has come up with to solve these problems, like egg donation, egg freezing, and surrogacy. So overall, I guess my question is, do you think that these third-party techniques, such as egg selling, surrogacy, and freezing, are another way to like benefit off women rather than really help them? Or do you think these, really put another way, do you think these high-tech solutions are really offering solutions?
Well, I think that's the question that I wish more people were asking, and the conversation that I think more feminists need to be having. And what I've seen is a kind of knee-jerk response, like what you were just describing, like, oh, like egg freezing is the next pill. This could be as revolutionary as the pill. We can freeze the biological clock. You know, we have control finally. And, you know, my understanding of egg freezing is that it's, I don't know if it's a false promise, but it's way more complicated than, the way it's often reported. You know, you're not really freezing any biological clock. Like, you're freezing eggs maybe in a moment in time that where they might be more likely to be quote unquote healthy, but what you're essentially doing is saying is committing yourself to IVF with those very eggs when you're finally in a place in your life where you feel like you want to use them and get pregnant. And so, you know, if you're freezing them at age 30, presumably, you know, you're going to use them. Your body still has to be able to sustain the pregnancy. So you still are on the clock, you know, and I think, I don't know what the regulation is right now, but I know there's a kind of age cutoff. Maybe you know it better than I do, where, you know, clinics really don't want to try to implant after you're a certain age.
I feel like it's becoming a more of a gray area.
Okay.
As like, there's no, they have their recommendations, but what are those?
Right. And what I'm not sure of is if people understand what that means, like what you're signing yourself up for, because I have never heard anyone describe IVF or really any part of going through reproductive medicine as anything other than really difficult emotionally, physically, financially. Sometimes it's devastating. Sometimes it ruins marriages and relationships. Like, I've never ever heard anyone say it was no big deal, you know,
and the uterus is still aging, right? Like, your uterus is still aging, your body is still aging. And what people don't understand too is that statistically, your likelihood of IVF being successful drops dramatically as you age. So you might have a healthy egg, but you're setting yourself up for increasing technology use. So,
yeah. I had my first and only child at age 37, and I mean, I'm tired. you know, oh my God, like I think like I'm about to turn 45, and I'm like, I can't even imagine having a baby right now. I mean, that's just me. But I know people do. And my I have a grandmother who had a baby at 46. So I know it's totally possible. But yeah, I think that you can't freeze time, you can't freeze aging. You know, I think that we keep putting our faith in these technological fixes, and the quickness with which I've seen like smart feminist journalists like just get so excited and breathless about these technologies and like this is our pill is kind of, it's just really interesting to me. It's interesting to me that the response isn't like more questions, first of all. I mean, we didn't even talk about like, what are the risks? Like, we didn't even talk about that, but that's something that we're not following that very well. We know there are risks to the pregnancy and the babies, and that's also not discussed very much. Right. We know that babies that are, conceived and gestated who have come from IVF are more likely to be, to have birth defects, prematurity, you know, all that stuff. So like, we know that doesn't get talked about very much. But I do, I think, you know, what I talk about in the book is that I feel like we haven't quite reconciled, like we really don't want to reconcile biology. we have these organs, they do this thing, and they are on a clock. And you know, we have science to look at to tell us, yeah, I think what the numbers I'm thinking of are that between age 41 and 44, the chances of that IVF cycle working go way down. Like they drop from not very good to like 2%.
Yeah.
And don't quote me on that, but it's something like that.
Yeah, it's like 3% something. Yeah, you're very close.
Yeah, yeah. And so like, you know, it definitely doesn't mesh well with the society we've built and the culture we've built, that requires, you know, if you want to be in the not struggling class, you know, you need to get your act together and get this career going. And, you know, you need to be working hard during those years of your prime fertility. We just have not reconciled this. Yeah. And that's like the bigger project that, and feminists have been, you know, they've been advocating for childcare. You know, there's been advocacy. It's not like this doesn't exist. But I think that the tendency to like look for a technological fix has been too tempting, and we're a little too credulous. Like, we need to be asking a lot more questions before we say like, this is our next pill. Yeah. We've solved it.
The fertility industry is happy to provide that next fix because it's a $1 billion industry. Like, sure, yeah. I'll do this for you, you know? Right. And I think there are two other like really big things that I wish people would think about this more. And you touched on it. It's the lack of the risks that we don't know, egg donors largely. It's that we're not doing any research, any follow-up studies on how these women are faring. These are healthy, young, smart, educated women with bright futures. And I'm a part of different groups where I see this like, because of the hormones that they're subject to, or because of donating their eggs so many times, or the ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, they are dealing with lifelong consequences, health consequences for that. And then now even with like the advent of 23andMe, they're able to find these relatives, these half, you know, these donor conceived people. And so they're having social issues, you know, mental health issues as far as like, okay, I donated this biological material and now there's a little half of me running around. And so there's that whole aspect that we're just not following these women. And then two, the big elephant in the room that we're creating another big gap between like socioeconomic people, right? Like, because you're not going to see the Kim Kardashians of the world who are hiring surrogates, they're not lining up to be surrogates for their housekeepers or their cooks, or, you know, it's like this weird dichotomy. And you talk about how women of color are more likely to deal with infertility or struggle with it, but are less likely to get treatment. And so we're kind of creating this class system where you can, those who can afford these technologies and those who can provide them. And we, yeah. You talk to in your book about, we don't seem to value the womb so much. And you talk about the hysterectomy side thing, but I was thinking about that. And it's like, we only value it if we need it, right? Like, so in a young girl, we value her womb, who can, but then we disregard it in the older population or women who are infertile. But
yeah, I just want to pull up parts and layers. So yeah. I was primarily talking about the phenomenon of freezing your eggs which is essentially an egg donation, right? It's like the same thing that a person would do to get reimbursed, right? And then like you're talking about, like, find out that they have a a being, a person who's made up of their genetic material living in the world, right? So yeah, so we're basically, I think that's that kind of got missed in the coverage. Like freezing eggs is essentially an egg donation for yourself, for your future self. And then you're taught, then the other layer is the market of surrogacy for people who have aged out of their own reproductive capacities or tried it, failed, right? So that's like the next step. And that, yeah, so that path of infertility is like, if IVF doesn't work, or first it's Clomid and then it's IUI and then it's IVF. And then if you've exhausted all that possibility, well, then your next step is to hire a surrogate. And, you know, I try to like be the one to ask the questions, right? Then rather than be the advocate. And so I think like I've asked questions about this too, because you're asking another person now to take what's not an insignificant risk with their body to carry your, you know, a baby for 9 months, give birth. And this just raises so many ethical and rights issues, right? Because the gestational parents, quote unquote, right, who have maybe their genetic material is now inside the surrogate, they feel an ownership over that pregnancy now. And so who gets to decide? Questions about everything from like what the woman who's carrying that baby eats during pregnancy to what kind of birth she's going to have. And it gets really messy. And so like, have we stopped and thought about this enough and said, like, is this right? Is this, because if our culture is leading us to this end where we haven't been able to, I keep saying use, it's not really the right word, but take advantage of like the reproductive capacity of our bodies in the time that it's available to us. If we haven't been able to do that, then we're turning to another human being to take on those risks. And is that okay? Like, I don't want to answer that question, but is that okay? Is that okay for, you know, for me individually? Is that okay for us? Is that okay for, you know, feminism to say that's okay? Like, I think that these are really important questions that need to be asked.
For sure. For sure. I want to take a shift for a second because I know I don't have much time left with you. But another thing I kept thinking about, and again, this might be not something you want to answer, but we can certainly discuss it. But you talk about, you know, birth control and hormones, and especially in young girls, and how we're like kind of over prescribing, maybe, if you will, birth control for anything. It used to be this really big, you know, women got freedom from it because they were able to enjoy life without the consequence of having a baby. But now it's just like a pimple pusher. You know, the kids come in, they have acne, they're going to be on birth control. But just this year, we co-wrote and co-directed a documentary on the medical transitioning of children. And I couldn't help, when I was reading those chapters, thinking about if we're not doing the same thing to those young children by over giving hormones early to pause puberty, so to speak. And I just wondered, do you have any thoughts on that? And because you have wrote this book a while ago, and now we're kind of seeing this where young children are medically transitioning. Do you think that there's a parallel there at all? And I just kind of wanted to pick your brain on that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a ton. I'm trying to learn a little bit more about the debate there. And I do think that, you know, the trans community just needs to be just as vigilant about the overuse of drugs and surgery as we all do. Mm-hmm. And to ask all the important questions, you know, what are the impacts of this? How is it impacting a person's sexual response and function? What are the possible side effects? What are the possible physiological impacts? Like, I think that all of those questions are really important. And yeah, I mean, I think the pill was revolutionary when it was first on the market. There's no doubt about that. You know, historically, it offered an unprecedented level of freedom for women at a time when they didn't have as much as we do now. And that said, like, we have learned a lot more about what being on continuous hormonal birth control or contraception, you know, what kind of impacts that has on the body. And we know now that there are pretty significant impacts on metabolism and bone density, and mood and libido and sexual response. And, you know, the more research that's done asking those specific questions, you know, the more we learn that, you know, it's not an innocuous vitamin. It's a systemic drug. Our endocrine system is very complicated and it's all connected. So you can't just shut down the sex hormones without affecting the rest of the body. And so, you know, I think, like, again, these are conversations that we need to be having more of. And I think they are happening a little bit more now. I documented in the book how some of the feminist journalists who were raising these questions, you know, 10, maybe 15 years ago, were really, they really had a hard time in the public domain. You know, they were accused of being anti-abortion and right to lifers and prudes, and, like, you know, they want to destroy women's sex lives. And that was really unfair because they were asking these really important questions about, like, you know, if it's doing, I mean, you know, and I mean, I was on the pill for 7 years. I didn't really notice anything. I didn't gain a ton of weight. I had a boyfriend, you know, I like, it didn't affect me in the way it affects some people, but there, you could talk to other people who gained a ton of weight, felt really horrible, became near suicidal, and, like, didn't, no one told them that it could be the pill.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, like, these are, and when you look at, you know, there's the pill, but there's also the patch and the ring and the shot. And, you know, you can look at all those individually. They have physiological impacts and they have risks. You know, I've talked to parents who've lost daughters to blood clots and strokes that were in products that have a much higher risk of those things happening than the second generation pill. And so, like, and I talk about this in the book, you know, we've allowed these products to stay on the market on the argument that they provide more options, right? That the more options we have, the more unwanted pregnancies will be prevented and the better off everyone will be. And I think that it's really a legitimate question to ask why a pill that has 2 to 4 times the risk of a blood clot as another brand of pill, of which there are 80 different brands in that class of pill. So there's a lot to be choose from. Like, why that one has to stay on the market? I don't, I mean, I think it's a really legitimate question, and it was asked at the FDA. And, you know, it was interesting to see how different groups lined up. Planned Parenthood came out and said, the more options, the better. We don't want any markets off, any products off the market. And I saw the same thing with the eShore device that I reported on. Yeah. And, you know, we sort of, like, got really excited about this technology without asking some really important questions. And it took, you know, 12, 15 years and lots of advocacy on the part of women who'd been harmed, and a Facebook group and trips to the FDA and meetings with the FDA director and a documentary and an article. You know, it took all that and researchers who listened to these reports and actually did some structured research and found, actually, yeah, this product has a way higher rate of harm than what we already had, which was, you know, you can get your tubes tied or you can have an IUD till you're 48 and, you know, be done with it. So, like, even just the idea that you need a permanent implant in your body for birth control when your reproductive life is going to be over before you're 50.
Right.
And then this thing is supposed to stay in your body for the rest of your life. Like, just that
many more years left.
Just the concept of that product really needed some deep questioning. That actually, it's not even that deep. It's pretty obvious to me. Like, wait a minute, why do I need a permanent device in my body when there's no chance I'm getting pregnant after permanent. That's right. Yeah. So, did I answer your question?
No, you did. And you actually brought up, and I just want to kind of echo, nothing to add, but, like, you know, you talked about, and I read it in your book as well, about how people who are kind of, you know, raising their hand, wait a second, like, I'm not sure this is great, were ostracized or pushed off as, like, oh, you're, you know, and I'm seeing the same thing again in the, like, the transgender movement. If you dare say about children, hold on, I don't know if these hormones are great, then you're automatically labeled, like, transphobe or whatever. And I just think it's important that we don't, and that's why I like this podcast, is I don't want people to lose sight on the fact that we should be discussing these things. These things should not be hush-hush. These things, it shouldn't be bad for someone. Someone shouldn't get canceled because they're concerned about children. They're concerned about hormones. They're concerned about products like in women's healthcare. So I have a couple more questions. If you have a few more minutes before we went recording, you talked about you're working on your last book, Everything Below the Waist, that we've been talking about, was written a couple of years ago. What have you been working on now? What can listeners expect down the pipeline?
Well, I've been reporting a little bit on COVID issues. And I just want to say, I completely agree with you that, you know, questions should be okay. I mean, that is what I do as a journalist. And these are important questions. And anytime you're talking about putting anything in your body or taking a treatment, you know, and especially when the issue is children who are questioning their bodies and their gender, you know, what's best for them. Like, I firmly stand behind open dialogue and, no, there are no questions that are off limits or, you know, I don't think a question, about what is the best way to treat this person? What's the best thing to do right now to help them, you know, to label it hateful or transphobic or, violence, you know, is really chilling speech and very hurtful to parents. And it's, I don't think it's helpful to kids or the field of medicine, really, because, you know, science is a tool. It's, you know, it's the act of questioning what's happening, trying to make sense of it, trying to figure it out. And, you know, I think we're seeing this with COVID too, that certain questions or certain topics are being labeled off limits, they're being labeled conspiracy, you know, and like, we need to be asking about whether, you know, at this point in the pandemic, whether kids in school who are young, children under the age of 8 or 6 or however you want to slice it, but what is wearing a mask every day and seeing their caregivers wearing masks, what's that doing to their development? Like, that's a very reasonable question to be asking at this point in the pandemic. And, you know, like all of the, you know, the way that we, you know, we didn't talk about schools for a long time. Like, we, last fall, we had a lot of data on schools. And even that, you know, to talk about, you know, schools being open, that was deemed, you know, too controversial, or, you know, you're right wing for saying that. It's really, you know, I don't think it's productive or helpful to be so polarized and to be so tribal and to immediately reject something just because someone who you perceive to be ideologically opposed to you thinks it's a good idea. So I've done some reporting recently about immunity following infection of COVID, otherwise known as quote unquote natural immunity. The New York Times just referred to it as so-called natural immunity. This is a textbook, immunological concept that I think we all pretty much understand because you and I probably had chickenpox as a kid and we're considered immune.
Right.
So if you and I had to go to elementary school again, we wouldn't be taking the vaccine because we already have antibodies. We've already been through that. I have scars to prove it. I had a really bad case when I was in the 8th grade. So like, this is a concept we've known, and you know, it's not controversial in the context of chickenpox or measles or Hep B or, you know, several other diseases. Like, in fact, if your child has antibodies to those diseases right now, and they're mandated by school to get that vaccine, they're exempt. You show their blood test, they don't get that vaccine. They already have the antibodies. COVID is new. So granted, like in the beginning, okay, we're not sure what this thing is, whether we can treat it like most other diseases. But pretty quickly we started studying the early people who were infected and following them. And by last fall, we had a good amount of data that people who had had COVID were developing strong immune responses. And now we have even more data. And, you know, you can parse it and, you know, there's a little bit of conflicting, you know, there are dozens of studies, so not all of them are going to come out with the same result. But basically, you know, we're seeing very, very low reinfection rates among both people who were infected with COVID and fully vaccinated. And Israel just released a study that's still in preprint. And this was during Delta. So, you know, that one found that people who had had COVID were actually much less likely to be reinfected than fully vaccinated. And we seem to be getting more data that there's a waning of immunity from the vaccines. We're talking about boosters now. So, but it's been really interesting to see this conversation because for a long time, it was really only Fox News and Tucker Carlson and, you know, people who I would normally never turn on, and 99% of what they say, you know, I scream at the TV if I do. Yeah, there's Tucker Carlson making sense. Even Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a broken clock can be right twice a day. So
love it.
You know, Trump said he was immune and Twitter labeled his post misinformation.
Yeah.
I mean, like, when we let politics and ideology get in the way of a rational conversation, where we discuss and debate what does the science say? What is the best thing to do? I think you saw this early on with whether we should lock down.
Right.
You know, God forbid, you know, you go against the dominant consensus as it was, you know, laid out. And that's, you know, I think in a democracy, in an enlightened society, that's not what we do. We can disagree. We should be able to be adults who disagree and bring different evidence to the table and, you know, grapple with the science and continue talking. Because once we start labeling people anti-science, conspiracy, immoral, like, that's very easy to shut down conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to whip up a Twitter mob. But it's inherently anti-science to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, that's where I wrote a big piece for the BMJ about natural immunity, why it doesn't count in the U.S., why, you know, the mandates are not making exemptions for it. And so it reviews all the science and a little bit of the politics. And so I'm working on more along that line of inquiry. Wow. And we'll see where that takes me.
Well, I'm excited to read it. I've really enjoyed your books. I really enjoy, you had a piece recently about, actually, I don't know if it was that recent, but I just recently read it about midwifery care and a woman in,
upstate New York.
Yes. Who's struggling with that. I have so much to talk about.
I'm really happy to tell you that all but one of the charges have been dropped.
Yay, good. Yeah, well, I was following that. I loved your report on that. And I do think that ultimately, as far as women's healthcare, returning it to midwifery is a good solution. And I like what you had to say about that in the book and in your report. So I encourage all of our listeners, I'm going to wrap up because I do want to be very respectful over time. I encourage all of our listeners to go check out Jennifer's writings and books, and you can check out her work on jenniferblock.com. I will include that in the intro clickable link for those who get our email and for those who see it on iTunes and other places. But thank you so much for taking your time out of your day to chat with me on Venus Rising. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Callie. And if you're on Twitter, you can follow me at Writing Block. So the pun on my last name, WRITINGBLOCK. And that's where I post most of the time now.
Yes. And so, I will include that as well, and a clickable link for our listeners. But I think today we have definitely accomplished our goal here on Venus Rising, which is create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage all our listeners to think beyond the masses. Have an excellent day.
Thanks, Kelly. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.